Hey everyone, welcome to the New Insight podcast, where we interview the most important movers and shakers in ophthalmology and give you new insights on the innovations ahead. I'm your host, Viral Sheth. My guest today is Charlie Wyckoff. Dr. Wyckoff is the Director of Research at Retina Consultants of Texas and the Deputy Chair of Ophthalmology for the Blanton Eye Institute at Houston Methodist Hospital. He received his undergraduate degree from MIT, PhD from Oxford, MD from Harvard, and did his residency at Bascom. Basic science research related to how cells adapt to oxygen availability in VEGF biology contributed to the 2019 Nobel Prize in Medicine. He's been awarded a number of scholarships, including the Marshall Scholarship, the Heed Fellowship, and the Ronald G. Michaels Award. Recently served on the board of the ASRS and is a founding member of the Ophthalmology Retina Editorial Board, and has been awarded the ASRS Young Investigator Award and the AAO Secretariat Award. In our conversation, we touch on a number of topics. We start with the changing landscape of retinal therapeutics, including the recent approval of pegcetacoplan for our geographic atrophy patients, and a little bit about what life is like in our clinics since the treatment became available. We talk about some of the early struggles adjusting to this paradigm shift, as well as optimism in where we're heading in the near term and the long term for our patients. We then get into a discussion on pipeline and what's exciting, what's heading our way, in addition to some of the challenges in general with clinical trial design, and perhaps maybe some ways to address some of those issues and some of those structural issues that we're seeing to bring newer therapies to those in need. We then pivot a little bit and talk a little more about Dr. Wyckoff's personal journey, where he's been, and where he sees himself going. Charlie and I met nearly two decades ago while we interviewed for residency positions, and so I'm happy to give our listeners some new insights into someone that has had such a profound effect on our field and that will undoubtedly do for so many years to come. And so without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Charlie Wyckoff. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. I know you're a busy guy, and so you taking time out of your schedule is much appreciated.
Viral, great to be here with you. Looking forward to the discussion.
Yeah, listen, so let's just dive right in. You know, you've obviously been busy in the space. Our space has been busy, right? We've had a lot of innovation in the past few years, but in the past 12 months in particular, new anti-VEGF therapies, and in particular, more recently, really hitting a new unmet need for us, which is geographic atrophy with pegcetacoplan. So now that it's been out, you know, you and I got to talk when the data was presented, and we've talked since, and now that it's out and it's in your hands and it's in your practice, you know, what are you seeing, and how are your patients reacting to that, and how are your partners reacting to that?
Yeah, it's a big step forward, but it's not an easy step forward. And there's so much to unpack here. But at a high level, I truly do believe that this is a really important step forward for the field. I think this is a meaningful medication. I think it brings meaningful benefit to patients. We can talk about that efficacy, but there are meaningful risks that come along with it. And it's important that we as physicians in our space and our patients understand those risks. And the efficacy is not great. And the safety is real. And so it's really a balance here. And what I'm finding as I'm discussing this with patients and other physicians is that this is a significant chair time issue, right? Patients are interested in the details. They know they're losing vision from the dry component of macular degeneration. We've been telling them that for years with and without anti-VEGF dosing for wet AMD concurrently. And you know, they're interested. They want something for this. But it's not easy to explain this drug, right? We have to convey that patients are not going to get better, that they're going to continue to get worse, but that worsening is going to be reduced compared to what it would have been without treatment. And those are not simple things to describe. And so I'm finding spending a lot of time with patients. I'm trying to get my team members, my staff, my awesome staff sort of educated so they can help have those conversations repeatedly. We've made handouts about this. We're pointing them to online resources. It's an educational challenge here for patients, but a really important one to engage with, because I'm really hesitant to initiate therapy for patients unless they really kind of express an understanding and sort of a long-term commitment to this. Because I believe that giving a few shots of, you know, any of the complement inhibitors, the one that's FDA approved, but any of the other ones being studied that I can see, is not going to make a meaningful difference, right? This is a long-term commitment to therapy. So I want to make sure that patients and their caregivers are on board before we initiate that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. I think we're you know, kind of recalibrating, right? I think we were all really excited to get the first drug approved. I mean, you and I have worked on geographic atrophy trials for many, many years and sort of finally get something to go through that shows some efficacy has been exciting. And to balance that with, okay, well, what is the realistic expectation? How am I going to present that to a patient? So let me ask you, because in those years that we've been talking about this, you know, we've kind of tried to figure out who the ideal patient is, right? Yeah, you know, is it the monocular patient that's losing vision now in their better eye? Is it, you know, someone that's lost vision in both eyes? Is it someone that's never lost vision, but we want to prevent them from that? So in the early stages, and we know we're in inning number one still, right? Who are you kind of starting to have these conversations with, knowing that, look, it is a lot of chair time and I do need someone in this for the long haul?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the challenge is, I can describe you the perfect patient, but most of my patients aren't going to be that perfect patient. And so I sort of have changed my mentality on this. Before it was approved, I would sit there and say, well, of course, it's the patient that lost vision in one eye with a lesion that's well outside the fovea in the other eye, and you can slow that progression, and that will theoretically translate to increased longer benefit for the patient functionally from foveal preservation. And we have some data, especially from pegcetacoplan recently, that may be the case, that if you start earlier before the fovea is involved, you do have more of a benefit. But what I'm finding as I bring this thing into the clinic is that it's more patient-specific than that. So I have a lot of foveal-involved patients that are very interested in getting treated, and they want to get treated as soon as possible, and I'm treating them. And those aren't the perfect patients. And I have half the patients I've treated. I've treated over 100 patients at this point. I've been intentionally an early adopter because I was excited about it and been talking about it with patients before it was approved. About half of the patients that I've treated have concurrent wet AMD. And I'm very careful with those patients. I really want to see lesions on fundus autofluorescence that are expanding over time, that have hyperautofluorescence at the border, that are behaving like a traditional geographic atrophy lesion, right? Because the risk is, I don't want to be injecting patients that have these punched out lesions from atrophy, from a regressed CNV that are not expanding. So I'm really sort of being selective in the wet AMD patients, but we all do have wet AMD patients with what I believe is concurrent geographic atrophy that's progressing. So those patients have actually been the earliest adopters for me because they're used to getting shots already.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think you know, the community's asking, right? Who do I approach with this, and what is the level set for these patients? So I think that's great. So knowing that, you know, we've got this new drug, we've potentially got a second new drug on the way later this year, and knowing what you know about the pipeline ahead, you know, where do you see this, knowing that we're in inning one, where do you see this, how do you see this unfolding over the next few innings? Yeah. Where are we a year from now and a few years from now?
Yeah, I would encourage the docs out there, get a good handout, either borrow somebody else's or get one from a company or make one yourself. And the first conversation, right, this is not a rapidly progressive disease. It's faster progressing than we gave it credit to for a generation. We've talked about that for the last couple of years, but it's also not an emergency in any capacity. So I have conversations with patients. I say, take this material home, think about it, and then come back. And if you want to get treated in a month, 2 months, 3 months, no problem. We'll start then. So give your patients time to think about it. Give them material. Point them to online resources so they can get educated sort of asynchronously, and you don't have to do all the education at once yourself. I think that helps a lot. So what I think we're going to see is that some patients are going to be very interested and they're going to engage, and other patients are going to be hesitant. But I think this is going to be more of a patient-level decision rather than a physician-level decision to me. I think it's important that patients get educated. And as I'm seeing, some patients are very interested, whereas others are not. Sort of how clinical trials evolve, I think, is a fascinating question. Because I do think over the next couple innings, we're going to see more and more patients want to begin therapy. Now, are they going to really continue therapy indefinitely for many years? I don't know. We've heard a lot of talk about the discontinuation rate. It is probably going to be fairly high. But that said, again, I think it's going to be a very individual decision. Some patients are going to be committed to this long term. And so I think we got to be careful about oversimplifying and overgeneralizing here. This is an individual patient-centric decision, both for initiation and continuation.
Yeah. And I think that applies to the physicians too, right? I think, you know, for those that haven't been used to these conversations or are not used to treating patients in these clinical trials, because we know, you know, a lot of times halfway through these trials, the patients, they get tired and they want to drop out, and, you know, you have to kind of encourage them. So I think there's going to be some learnings on all sides of it, you know, from patients and providers as well. So that's good. You know, you touched on something about clinical trials, and I want to talk a little bit about that. You're on a lot of these steering committees, and you've been working on clinical trials for many years and know them inside out better than most people. And so, you know, my question is, you know, being in that role, what, you know, you and I, when we finished training about, 15 years ago or something, we came out, and today we practice medicine very differently than we did, you know, when we finished training. But from a clinical trial standpoint, we're still doing clinical trials very similarly to what we were at 2010 and before that even. And so the question to you is really, all right, how do we advance that aspect of things? How do we modernize clinical trials? I know you've been working on ways of kind of streamlining trials and making sure data is accurate and making sure we're doing things in a timely fashion and not having to, you know, maybe enroll large, long studies because it takes forever to get answers. And so what are some of the things you're seeing? What are the trends that you're seeing? Where do you think we should go?
Yeah, fascinating. Man, there's so much to unpack there. I guess where I would start is, you know, how things have changed in the last 15 years. You know, there's certainly a lot more high quality clinical trial centers across the US, and I applaud that. I think that we as a country and then globally are enrolling complicated trials remarkably efficiently now. I mean, if you look at one of the most recent examples, GATHER2, right? Really challenging trial to enroll, very specific geographic atrophy phenotype. And that enrolled remarkably quickly. And we've learned as a field how to do complex clinical trial enrollments and then engage the patients long-term, both in the U.S. and internationally. And the pivots I see that are ongoing now are endpoints, for example. So we have a lot more FDA-approvable endpoints than we did when you and I came out or at a training. You know, the DRSS has been validated as an endpoint for diabetic retinopathy. We have, you know, OCT validated as an endpoint for vitreo macular traction and probably MacTel. And then we've got fundus autofluorescence as an endpoint. So all these exciting anatomic endpoints that had not been validated or proven when we came out, it was really exciting to me. And what's more exciting is looking forward and seeing new endpoints that are being discussed with the FDA. For example, ellipsoid zone changes in geographic atrophy and also intermediate dry AMD are a very hot topic. And I think going to be the next sort of approvable endpoint for earlier stages of dry AMD, the intermediate stage, but also the geographic atrophy stage. Because fundus autofluorescence, this gets into the weeds a little bit, but is not simple. It's not simple to obtain a high quality FAF image. It's not simple to grade it. I mean, our reading centers are really good at doing that, but we've seen some high profile clinical trials not meet their primary endpoint, probably partially at least related to the way the anatomic data was collected and analyzed, which is, you know, a tragedy. If drugs don't work, then we should leave them behind. But to have trials fail because of an operational or an imaging-based problem is a failure for all of us, because that's just wasted resources that are not helping our patients. So I'm a big believer in developing new approvable endpoints that are more efficient to access and then more efficient to analyze. I think OCT is going to bring some value there.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I think there's always a challenge then tying it back to the clinical side of it, right? I mean, even with what we're seeing with GA right now, you know, I think recently, you know, we saw some data from both Apellis and Iveric tying, you know, their outcomes and their trials to back to vision, right? I think we're seeing that because I think we still need to see that and need to be able to communicate that to our patients. So where we'll be, you know, a few years from now and these other endpoints and then how we'll be able to tie those back is going to be interesting. But I agree with you. I think we need to go beyond some of those kind of traditional endpoints that we're using for sure.
You know, you're so right. I think of it this way. For anatomy, we can dissect at the micron level, right, on multiple imaging modalities. We're very good at high resolution imaging. At a functional level, we're dissecting at like the mile level. Like we're nowhere near micron sensitivity, like foveal high contrast visual function is very relevant, of course, to patient function, but it's just one component of their visual world. And we are very, very immature in our clinical trials and especially the provable endpoints when it comes to visual function, right? And the challenge is that we've seen signals now. I believe the microperimetry signals that we're seeing in the Oaks trial with pegcetacoplan, I think that those are real, But it's hard. It's hard to operationalize microperimetry, and it's hard to make patient-specific grids, right? So I think we're going to see an evolution of that. The MacuStar program out of Europe is pioneering sort of this sort of onion ring pattern with microperimetry, where you create little dots all the way around the patient-specific sort of pattern based on their area of atrophy. I think that's really exciting and could be an approvable endpoint. The other easier one is, I think, contrast sensitivity. There are some new devices for contrast sensitivity that I think are improving our ability to distinguish functional deterioration at earlier stages of disease in both AMD at the intermediate dry AMD stage and also in different stages of diabetic retinopathy. So I'm hopeful that that more detailed functional analyses, dark adaptation being another one for earlier stages of AMD, may allow us to begin to piece out the functional benefits or maybe no functional benefits of therapies that are coming along. But I agree, really important for us to continue to push that and hopefully get it to where we are with the anatomic analyses that we have.
Yeah, no, fascinating. So let me ask you, I'm going to switch from the science stuff to the little more personal stuff. So, you know, now here we are, you know, a decade and a half into the career. You know, you've gotten numerous awards. I think just even last year or 2 years ago, Young Investigator Award, ASRS. So, you know, you're looking back now, and what are you kind of most proud of, and what are you most maybe surprised of about, you know, in that journey that you've taken? I mean, are you where you thought you were going to be? Is this where, you know, Charlie Wyckoff 2023 was supposed to be, or tell me a little bit about that now that you've had a chance to look back a little bit.
You know, I enjoy what I do. I feel very fortunate to do what I do. I'm blessed to do what I do. But I appreciate today more than ever the fact that it takes a team. It really does take a village. None of this is possible in isolation or a vacuum. At least none of the stuff that I've ever done that's meaningful in retina or ophthalmology. You know, it all takes a team. And I'll start with my research team, right? I have like 100 employees in Texas that do research full time. And I couldn't do anything without them. I mean, they help me with all the regulatory documents. They help me with all of the protocol, you know, staying up with the amendments, the patient sort of recruitment. Everything that we do depends on my staff. And I love them for it. And we had, you know, a big staff party last night. We try to be very inclusive with our staff, make sure they know they're part of a team. I love being a part of that team. I love engaging and teaching and leading that team. That has been really rewarding to me. And then similarly, externally, right? I mean, Viral, you and I are fortunate to work on a lot of the same committees, right? In leading these clinical trials and steering development of protocols. And I love that stuff. I love getting into the weeds. I'm a weeds kind of person. But I really enjoy being able to do it with smart, hardworking people like yourself and many others in our space that are truly dedicated to the science here. You know, occasionally you come across a group, and I'm just being honest and open here, that's more focused on sort of an angle that I'm not as interested in, and we won't go into detail about that, but, and then I kind of walk away, right? We're all too busy to do stuff that's not going to fit with what you believe in. And I've become really passionate, more so than ever, about advancing our space. I love working hard with people that are doing things to advance our space for the science and for patients. And when I get to do that, I'm thrilled with what I get to do in life.
No, that's well said. So, all right. So then you're at this point now. Now you look ahead at the next 10, 15 years. So where are you in the year, you know, 2033, 2035, somewhere in that time frame?
You know, I say this to my kids. I have a bunch of quotes that I give to my kids all the time. And one of them is, you can do almost anything in life, but you can't do it all at exactly the same time, right? And so I do believe that there's a season for almost everything in life. And I don't know what my next season is going to be. Right now, I love what I'm doing and I wouldn't trade it, right? I've looked at, you know, for example, you know, like we've all looked at things like, you know, a chief medical officer position or a chief scientific officer position where you kind of go all in on one sort of pipeline. And that's not in the cards for me right now, maybe in the future. I've also thought a lot about international clinical trials, right? We do so many clinical trials in the U.S. We do them at such a high level at sites like yours, Viral, and many others. And I really have a passion about trying to develop sites like that ex-U.S. I think there's a lot of opportunity there for a lot of reasons that could be valuable. So I'm very interested in that. I've been fortunate to work with a you know, hospital named Tilganga out of Nepal many years ago. And I'm very interested in getting back there and trying to drive clinical trials ex-US in really underserved areas. What that's going to look like, I don't know. But that in some ways might be the next season for me. But I, you know, I think we're all looking to always expand our horizons. That's what keeps it fun. That's what keeps it fresh, is that we're always all evolving. But in 10 years, I hope I'm doing what I'm doing, but at a different level. And maybe that looks like international.
Yeah. No, I hate to put you on the spot like that, but that it's a tough question to answer, right? I think every year you're probably doing something that you didn't really expect to be doing, and the next year and the next year. And so who knows where that will take you. But I'm excited. I'm excited to see what happens to Charlie in the next decade. So we'll be kind of sitting and watching that. So I'm going to bring it, you mentioned kind of international stuff. I'm going to bring it back to the U.S. for a second. So one of the projects that we worked on last year was looking at payers, right? And looking at U.S. payers in particular and things like prior authorizations. And I thought the work was fascinating. I really enjoyed kind of working with you guys on that. And so tell the listeners, because that might have not been something they were paying attention to. It's less, you know, science and treatment based. And, you know, it's really kind of looking at, you know, to your point, structure. You know, how do we address structural issues in our system and improving patient access and things like that? So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, interesting. I got involved with the ASRS board and got involved with their practice management committee. And in that committee, it became very clear as we fielded questions from and concerns from our colleagues across the country, you know, 3,000 and the docs across the country or so, that one of the biggest problems is prior authorizations, right? We see a new patient come in with wet AMD and they're 2080, 2200, and you can't give them a shot on that day. You got to bring them back. It feels criminal. And that's why we use samples. That's why we give drugs away for free many times, because it's the right thing to do. But it's not the right thing to do from an insurance perspective. And so I have been railing against prior authorization. And of course, I'm not the first voice to do so. And hopefully we'll be the last, but we're not going to be. This is a fight that continues to exist because the money is so big. And so in those discussion, actually tons of credit goes out to Sabine Deng. So Sabine Deng from St. Louis had this idea. He goes, you know, why don't we develop some data? Let's quantify this and look at the number of prior authorizations out there. Look at how this is interfering with care delivery. And so he came up with a very systematic plan to go out to multiple practices across the U.S., very diverse set of practices, both in practice structure and in practice location. For example, yours, Viral, and mine participated in, and we collected a lot of data for prior authorizations and basically showed that retina doctors are pretty good. Like if you submit a prior authorization, 99% of them are going to be approved, right? So what's the point? Is it really worth the paperwork, the hassle? We know it takes on average about 45 minutes worth of your staff time to do this for everybody listening out there, which is mind-numbing how many hours of staff time that is when they could be educating patients about the values and risk of pegcetacoplan. But no, they're stuck in a cubicle filling out paperwork to get the Aetnas of the world to approve our Avastin. It's painful and it's a waste of resources. So we are fighting at the ASRS level to change that. Important, there's people like Sabine out there that are coming up with ideas to generate data. So we're in the process of publishing that and then using that as ammunition against the insurance carriers to try to prevent a prior authorization and the dominant force that it continues to play in so many commercial plans.
Yeah, and that's why I brought it up, because I don't think I realized how much time our staff was spending on that. And then when we actually had to sit down and track it and document it, it was eye-opening. And so I wanted to bring it up because I don't think people realize how much of a burden and struggle these things can be for practices, especially, you know, smaller practices. And so I'm glad you guys and Sabine were kind of shining a light on that and wanted to kind of bring that up as well. So good. So listen, last thing I want to talk about is something that's been kind of the hot topic, you know, in terms of where we're moving in our research space and the pipeline in general, is gene therapy. And so I wanted to kind of get some thoughts because now, you know, we've been seeing data come out and we've got multiple companies, whether it's, you know, the Adverums, the Regenix, the 4DMTs, and a lot of activity in that space. So, you know, if I would ask you this question a year ago or 2 years ago, your answer might have been different, but where are we now and kind of where are we going? What are you seeing working and what are you excited about?
Yeah, when I look at the sort of ongoing clinical trial landscape, more excited than ever, actually. There's a lot of really cool stuff out there that's coming. And I put it in three buckets when I talk about this. One is sort of new mechanisms of action, which I'm truly probably most excited by. I just mentioned a few, like the FAST pathway, the Wnt pathway, SEMA3A, the mitochondrial, integrins. There's some really cool stuff that's coming that I think is going to be really helpful for patients in novel ways. The second category I talk about is like, you know, new drug delivery pathways. So we need better things than shots in the eye. Like we give a lot of them, I get it. A lot of our economic structure in retina is built around those injections, but we can evolve. We've evolved before. We need pills. We need subcutaneous shots. We need drops. We need things that are going to be easier to use and easier to deliver for broad segments of our population. And those are coming. And some of those trials are really cool and they're ongoing. And then of course, the third biggie is what I lumped together at first of gene therapy and stem cells. And I think that those both hold a lot of promise, but to focus on gene therapy in particular, there's sort of two categories there. One is sustained delivery for drugs that we know that already work, which are the examples that you pointed out beautifully. I do think those are going to be commercially viable. I hope all three end up commercially viable. I think that will be a value add to our patients. We have learned so much about gene therapy. For the first time ever in retina, in my doing research in retina, I saw a dose-limiting toxicity in humans. We saw cases of slower body shutdown and hypotony with the high dose of ADVM-022 in diabetic macular edema, and we caused some bad outcomes. But we've learned from that, and I don't think that we are at risk for seeing that again in the wet AMD program. I'm a supporter of all three of those programs that you mentioned. And I have patients enrolled in all three of those programs that you mentioned. So I believe that that is a major step forward and going to decrease the treatment burden for patients and meaningful step forward. The other angle of the gene therapy, which is equally fascinating, is the dry AMD space, right? Because I think that's even probably a bigger population, right? The gyroscope approach or the perceive approach, which is, you know, subretinal or intravitreal respectively for dry AMD. And it's starting with GA, but there's no reason it couldn't go to intermediate dry AMD. So I think if we could figure out a gene therapy for earlier stage of GA, intermediate dry AMD, that would prevent progression or delay progression to the advanced form, either one of the advanced forms, that would be truly a big step. And I think that's possible. And those analyses are ongoing, and trials future to come will go earlier in AMD. So really excited about gene therapy. I do think there's a possibility for commercialization from the lead program there, which is REGENXBIO, over the next couple of years. It looks like recently they expanded their trial size. That may be pushed out beyond a couple of years from now. But still, I think that is quite possible in the next five-year time horizon.
Yeah, I love the way you summarized it. I mean, I think that's exactly kind of the way we are presenting that to folks. And I think... you know, I don't think it's there's ever been a more exciting time, right? We've got so much activity. We've got so much that's been kind of approved in the last year that this kind of nexus is something that we haven't been able to experience, at least not in our careers. I mean, I think the biggest initial inflection point for us was the approval of the first anti-VEGF, right? And now, not since then have I thought that, okay, we're really kind of making huge leaps forward now. But I feel like we're either in the middle of that or on the verge of that now. So I love that summary, and I think that really kind of puts it well. Charlie, that's all I've got for today. You know, I'm sure we'll have you back at some point and revisit and kind of recalibrate to where we are in 2024 and beyond at that point. I want to thank you for your time, and I know, again, busy guy, get back to your family, and I want to just tell you I appreciate it.
Thanks, Real. Always good chatting with you.
Thank you for listening in to the New Insight podcast. We really appreciate your time. Be sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred listening or watching platform. And if you're interested in more ophthalmology news or other podcasts, visit hcplive.com and check out our offerings. For now, I'm Dr. Viral Sheth. Hope to see you next time to discuss what's new in sight.